Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only...
Only.
Only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts. I am Nicholas Miller, here, as always, with Steve Cato.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, weather's cooled off, puts me in a dandy mood. Feeling spry, feeling social, feeling
great.
Good. How about yourself?
Well, congratulations. I'm fine. Feeling okay.
Have you gotten any big bicycle rides in lately since the weather cracked?
Yeah, finally. I did. It felt good, but also I was like, it's weird, you know, it's like I hadn't been back at it for a while. But you know, it is what it is. I don't know. Yeah, it does feel weird to not do something for a long time, then do it again, and then be like, wow, crazy, I'm doing this. But oh well, yeah. How about you? Things that your sporting endeavors as always.
That's been good. Back to it. Healthy knee. I got my MRI, as we discussed previously on the talking show, feeling spry, feeling good. How do you feel about the big news, Steve?
What's the big news?
The big news.
That William Klein, director of Mr. Freedom, has died?
That, yes. And Mr. Chouinard stepped down at Patagonia.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, basically anything but the royal big news.
Well, you know, I am very sad about the queen. She was the sovereign. She's the only queen I've ever known as a Canadian.
Yeah. I guess she was your ruler, right?
Yeah, she was the head of state for most of my life. I guess from all of my life until very recently.
How old is Steve?
And I don't have a lot of context for other monarchic events, right? She became queen in the 50s. So... I suppose I have positive feelings about her as a monarch, but I also just don't have a wide sample. So we'll see how King Charles does, I suppose. But hopefully he does okay. You know, I wish him the best. He was a shitty prince, but you know, I live to forgive, you know?
Yeah.
Do you have any opinions? Has this affected the premiers? This has affected the soccer, right? Everyone had to stop playing.
It's heavily affected it. They stopped playing for 2 weeks. The claim is that it's because of police, like they don't have enough cops. I think that the football games in England get pretty rowdy, so fair enough, they need lots of police officers there. But it coincides with the Champions League, which is when the best teams of Europe play each other, and so that presents complications, you know, because like say Liverpool is playing Napoli in Italy. What do you do there? So then they made this hilarious concession this week where if an English team was hosting the game on English soil, then the Champions League anthem, which is based on Handel's Zodak the Priest, which contains some of the words that is sung during the funeral march of a ruler, a monarch.
What?
They were not play the Champions League anthem before each game, which is kind of a dramatic moment in the spectacle of the game where the teams line up and they play this horrible, like kind of orchestral song and then it's supposed to get everyone all excited. So they didn't do that this time.
In deference to the royal family.
Yeah, because it bears some vague resemblance to a Handel piece that that is played at the funeral of the queen or of the ruler.
Well, Handel is important to, the English royal family. He's like a big deal.
Right. But I think
it's a pretty big deal there.
They just took the melody or something. They didn't even, they don't play the Handel piece before the soccer match. So it hit a lot of, it struck a lot of chords for me. Soccer, history of Western art music.
Yeah, right.
Monarchic rule, all these things. So that was the greatest impact it had on my life.
I hope you get your soccer back.
Oh, well, they played the Champions League, so it's all fine.
Oh, weird. All right. Well, I wish them all the best as well.
Yeah, they just played it Sans theme song.
Weird. So and this like this piece of music that is like they have their own anthem for.
Yeah.
That's the part that blows my mind. I just do not understand that. Like you mean to tell me there's an entirely separate piece of music based on like Zodak the Priest? Like, is that, maybe I'm not the, I like to think that I know a lot about, classical music. Is that a known piece?
I'd never heard of it. I only encountered it through this news, the warning that,
you may not hear Zodak the Priest as you are, may not hear a piece of music based on Zodak the Priest as you are normally accustomed so to do.
Yeah, pretty much. That's how I encountered it. And I thought, well, what's Zodak the Priest?
beware.
Yeah.
That
caveat
is...
emptor.
Watch out. Zodak the Priest.
It'd be like if for some reason the theme of Game of Thrones was taken from a Handel piece, and they're like, well, this week on Game of Thrones, you're not going to hear the intro song, the du-du-du-du-du-du, that melody.
Yeah.
Way too similar to what we're going to play at the funeral. So it'll just be a silent intro for Game of Thrones this week.
I can't even. I just don't have any word. The words fail me. I hope everyone has a great soccer. I wish everyone a fantastic soccer.
Yeah, it's true. I did see a picture of a famous footballer. Like, I guess they like. I couldn't tell. This is what I wanted to know. I couldn't tell if they passed this book around, but it was the condolences book, and he was signing it like at the town hall in Liverpool. Like they sent the captain of the Liverpool team to go sign the condolences book for the Queen.
Sure,
and
sure.
I was like, does that book go on tour like for the week before the funeral? And like they take it to all the major towns and like the important people go and sign it. Like, oh, so sorry. Each town sends their own one in, and it's like a design contest.
I think each town probably sends their own in, but you'd be surprised at what's going on. Like, as I understand it, for whatever reason, they have to send a guy on horse. So like the Queen died and like literally everyone knew, you know what I mean? Like within 10 minutes or whatever, the palace is like, hey everyone, just making an announcement, Queen Elizabeth has died. But the next day, a guy on horseback has to head out from London at like dawn and ride to all the major cities in England and announce in the town. I'm not even joking. This is the thing a guy has to fucking do.
He makes tweets from each town.
A guy has to go there and tell everyone that this is happening. And it's like, you're telling an entire community that has been enduring like wall-to-wall media coverage the entire time about this very topic since like early in the morning the day before. It's mind blowing. It's just incredible. There's all this stuff that they just have to keep doing.
I did appreciate that they like this custom of telling the bees. I was happy to hear about that.
I was glad that the bees were told as well.
Yeah. I don't think that the coverage I saw, they didn't communicate how this talking works well enough for, a connoisseur of talking like myself, but I'm glad it was communicated to the bees in one way or another.
Me too. I hate it when no one tells the bee tells the bees what's going on.
Well, I hate an
apiarist. I hate an uninformed bee. Nothing less pleasant than bees that do not know stuff.
It's true. Yeah. And I wonder how often the royal bees are informed of things. Like, do they know who won the premiership each season?
Great question.
Yeah. But clearly it's important for them to know about the death of their ruler, but they're probably like, fuck that. We got our own queen. What are you talking about?
I wonder how that breaks down.
Because
these hierarchies are quite complex.
It's true. Yeah.
Maybe the worker friend of the talking show
killed the current bee queen. They said, well, what are you talking about? There's another queen.
It happens all the time.
That's true.
It's a regular part of Hive dynamics. But I think probably friend of the talking show, Chris Page, his family knows all about this stuff.
It's true. We'll have to phone a friend.
He's from a line of, yeah, we'll have to send out a lifeline.
Perhaps the pages are the ones that tell the bees.
Or they make sure that the person who tells the bees knows at the appropriate time. Like, you know, they aren't informed before the person who tells the horses, you know, or the corgis or whatever, whichever the hierarchy of the animals is, the royal creatures is. Yeah, I wonder. What a weird thing. It's fucked up. It's crazy that we live all the way over here and English is the language that is spoken. Like, you know, put that in your pipe and smoke it. It's pretty
true.
Weird.
It is true.
Like, really? That's what we do here? We speak English?
Yeah.
All the way over here?
Yep.
All the way over here. Absolutely bananas.
Yeah, and it seemed like there were a couple options there for a minute in terms of various colonial projects in this part of the
world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even, you know, I mean, I suppose we should be speaking some sort of Uto Aztecan language, really, if, you know, that would make the most sense.
Yeah.
Given where we live. But doesn't seem to have worked out that way. Weird. Real strange. No.
And speaking of strange historical circumstances that lead to very unexpected places, I think that's a natural segue to our guest tonight.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
For all of you who've been to Steve's studio, you've probably driven by the remarkable old Bullocks Wilshire building. And what corner is that on, Steve?
Oh, well, it's on Wilshire on the south side, just sort of a little bit east of Vermont.
Okay.
Like two blocks east of Vermont. I forget what the name of that street is. There's a really good taco truck there that I eat lunch at often. Toro Tacos.
You want to plug them? What are they called?
It's good. It's good. Toro Tacos.
Toro Tacos, everyone.
Yeah. Strongly recommend. They make their own tortillas. It's a big improvement, you know, like it's good when the tortillas are fresh. Tastes better.
So if you're going to Toro Tacos or just driving by, you'll notice this beautiful Art Deco building that now says Southwestern Law, but it was not built for that purpose. I know this may blow your mind.
No.
It was built for an entirely other purpose, which we have a whole load of guests in here tonight to work that out for us. So without any further ado, please welcome Huelhauser and the patrons of the Bullocks Wilshire Tea Room.
Well, I said this was the piece de resistance because what we're doing now, Leslie, is kind of recreating history.
Well, it's true. I mean, with the opening of the Tea Room and your being here again, we thought it would be fun to get some of the folks who remember what it was like to be here when it was a functioning tea room.
So we kind of have the tea room recreated
here. We've set up a little vignette here, and actually this is the way we do it when we have our special tour and tea during the holiday season.
With the tablecloths and all.
Tablecloths and the flowers. I think there were even originally printed menus available.
Wow.
And some of the original dishes from the Bullocks Wilshire Tea Room menu.
And some of the original patrons, because I remember this group right here, we talked with you back in the tea room back in 1993.
That's right. The last day it was to be serving lunch. And I took my daughter, Hillary,
who has grown up a lot,
yes, out of school for the day. I said, you have to come to the tea room and see what it's like to experience lunch with your mother at the Bullocks Wilshire Tea Room.
And you have taken her back out of school today.
Actually, she's out today. They had finals, so we're okay.
To come back. Yeah. And how does it feel to be back?
It is so beautiful here. What Southwestern has done to this room and building is incredible. It's exquisite.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful. And for people, I was expecting the chintz and the carpet and the little ladies in pink with the aprons, but I was pleasantly surprised it's been restored to its original beauty.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful.
It's original beauty.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, what do you think about it?
It's great. It's beautiful, and I love the ceilings and the floors. It's just, I really like it.
Do you remember that day 7 years ago?
I remember the carpet and...
the bad carpet.
Yeah. I just remember not wanting to be interviewed.
Oh. Well, you've grown up now, haven't you?
Yeah.
And what do you think about the new look?
I really like it. It's modern, and yeah. I really like it.
See, isn't that interesting? She said it's modern, but actually it's 30s.
It is. It's just every little detail has been attended to, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. Gorgeous.
You never know who you're going to meet in the old Bullocks Wilshire Tea Room. Introduce yourselves to it.
My name is Melissa Lynn, and I'm the manager here of the Tea Room.
You're the manager of. Do you still call it the Tea Room?
We do call it the Tea Room. Yes, we do.
Really?
Yeah. Not the Bullocks Wilshire Tea Room, but the Tea Room.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who is this lady with?
This is my mother, who greatly wanted to come to meet you today.
Your name is?
My name is Juliet Kipperman.
And your claim to fame here.
Well, it began when I was about 5 years old in 1949, when my mother would bring me to the tea room with my little white gloves on and my patent leather Mary Janes. But later on in life, I became a model for Bullocks, and Bullocks Wilshire borrowed me once for a show, a bridal show. So I modeled here in this room.
Really?
When I was about 23.
So you would what? Just wander around the tables and kind of twirl around, or what would you do?
There was actually a ramp in the form of a T, and we walked out of those doors on a ramp and we modeled bridal gowns.
And how does it feel to be back?
It's wonderful. It really is. It's very different, but it's great. And what's so exciting is that my daughter is managing this tea room.
Yeah.
Now, I brought her here when she was 5 years old.
Really?
Did the same thing. I had braids. I had to wear the gloves.
The white glove.
And my mom taught me the etiquette and the protocol of becoming a woman, becoming a lady, perhaps. So.
Now, the students today, this is, cafeteria-style eating.
Higher quality of cafeteria.
Well, but what I mean is they're not wearing white gloves.
No, of course not. No, they come with their books, and they open their books, and they eat, and they study at the same time.
But it's just another chapter in the tea room's history.
Right. It's very exciting to come back. It's been a long time. It's very different. It's Art Deco as opposed to the very frilly pink roses and green vines, but it's special, and it's... I'm very happy to be here, especially with my daughter.
Were you all here? I don't think I met you the last time,
did
I?
Not the last time. I'm director of development at the law school.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So you're eating over here, kind of hosting some of these other guests.
This guest, right?
And as director of development, this has got to help.
Oh, absolutely. This is just a wonderful opportunity for all of us.
Yeah. Glad to be back?
Wonderful to be back.
Well, now, how many times did you come here before?
Many, many times, because I produce chamber music and historic sites concerts, and we've held quite a few here, both at Bullocks Wilshire and now at Southwestern University. And every time I came when it was Bullocks Wilshire, I bought something, which is why I think they asked me back. And I came here to those final days in 93, and I have a story. I bought my earthquake coat the last day that Bullocks Wilshire was open. On the day of the 94 earthquake, my place was trash, and I couldn't open up any of the closets, and hanging out somewhere was that coat. So my costume for the day was a granny gown Reeboks and a Bullocks Wilshire coat.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
Ladies, now this is kind of like, this is the way it used to be. Ladies dressed elegantly.
I don't have my gloves on though.
Uh-huh.
But absolutely, this is the way it was. We
now,
remember it.
How many times would you come here?
Oh, weekly. On a weekly basis. Bringing our daughters and getting their wedding dresses and their bridesmaids' dresses and their Marlboro uniforms, and you know, we Miss Kessler sold toys. We got our babies' layettes here. We did everything here.
And coming here for lunch after you shopped was always a major part of the visit.
That's right. That was very special. The chicken salad, the tomato stuffed with chicken salad, the orange gooey rolls. It was all wonderful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Any memories you want to share with us?
Oh, Hugh, this has been the most wonderful place for all of us. We've done everything here. You know, we bought our wedding dresses and our bridesmaid dresses, our children's clothes, and came for to see Santa Claus. And lots of haircut.
Remember the little children's haircut place?
And do you remember it the way it looks now?
Yes. Well, of course, it was, you know, it had carpeting on the floor, which this is not this beautiful old floor was all covered up.
Right.
But, yeah, it looks very much like this.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you all back. Nice memories?
Oh, lots of memories. The Bullocks and the Winnetts, who ran the store, lived on Plymouth between 6th and Wilshire. And the Howards, my family, lived on Windsor between 6th and Wilshire. And my family were invited to their big parties here, which were held out on that balcony there.
We just went out there and looked at that. That is elegant.
Well, so were the women in those days, as well as the men. The women had those cloche hats, you know, and the short skirts, and were pretty gorgeous.
This was back in the 30s.
When they first opened the store. And then they had the big searchlights. Every time they had a party, you'd see them. That was Bullocks Wilshire was having a party.
Wow.
And we would come here. I heard someone, I think, say that they take you shopping, and then as a big treat, you'd get to come to the tea room.
Now, talk about elegant. Mrs. Cheesebrough is dressed in a very historic outfit.
Well, I don't know that it's so historic, but it was the last thing I bought in Bullocks Wilshire.
Well, that's historic.
All right.
So
that's fine.
Your head to toe.
Except the stone Martens, which I inherited from my mother-in-law. Oh. So you know how old they are.
Okay. So all of this is a Bullocks Wilshire
absolutely,
outfit.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I keep them for years, and I resurrect them about every 10 or 15 years, and it's lots of fun.
Now,
and
I know...
And I still get compliments on them.
I know it's been at least 7 years since you've been to lunch here.
Definitely, and it was just as delicious today.
And how many times would you have come here in years past?
Oh, very many times, because I have 6 children and I brought them for their clothes, and my 51-year-old boy was with me today, and he said, I remember when we used to go over there and buy some Keen shirts.
Wow.
So then they came to see Santa Claus and everything every year. So I have very, very many fond memories.
How would you describe not only this tea room, but this whole department store to people who never had the opportunity to experience it?
Well, I think it was one of the best department stores in the world, frankly, because it had such variety and such class in the real good sense of the word, the really good sense of the word.
My father founded Southwestern, and he died in 1944, and then my mother became president, and she carried on for about 20 years.
So you're connected with Southwestern, of course, which is the new tenant of this building. But the second reason you're here today is because you remember coming to tea and lunch in the old Bullocks Wilshire tea room.
I certainly do. And I remember purchasing my uniforms for school at Bullocks Wilshire.
Wow.
She
crosses two barriers here, Southwestern and Bullocks Wilshire. Your name is?
I'm Gretchen Gibbs. My father was John Schumacher.
The founder of Southwestern
yes.
School of Law. Ladies, this has been pretty exciting.
It certainly has.
Now, you know you've got a lot of ladies around town who are going to be very jealous of the fact that you've been back here.
I talked to one this morning, and she was green with envy. We talked about all the sales ladies that were here, and it was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, she really wanted to come.
Well, we only had a very limited supply of tickets and seats and salads
right,
with tablecloth
right.
and all that.
Right, and you haven't eaten yours yet.
I know, I'm going to eat mine here in just a minute. Louis, let's get a shot of these ladies right here. Here is the representing the Bullocks Wilshire Tea Room down here. You look out there, and in the background are the students, the new generation of people who are enjoying this grand old building. For those people who thought that Bullocks Wilshire and its grand tea room were gone forever, this is a reassurance that it is back, better than ever, and serving yet another generation of citizens of Los Angeles. It's been a great day here at the old tea room, the new tea room. And now for an update to the update. Leslie is still here, standing out in the parking lot. Good old Bullocks Wilshire, Southwestern Law School is still there.
We are.
It's been 10 years, can you believe it, since we were last here doing that update?
Feels like yesterday.
No, it doesn't. It feels like 20 years, but we're back. We're back to kind of get a little update about what's happening. I assume that Southwest Law School is established, is firmly entrenched in the building. Everybody's happy. It's a law library. It's a law school. The students, faculty, administrators have all kind of settled in.
They have, and we finished, you know, we took like 10 years to redo this whole building. And the last thing that we did was to create a fabulous courtroom on the bottom floor where they used to sell shoes and accessories.
Wow.
And then we had a gala that I think you were nice enough to
that's right. Well,
be our MC.
That's been a number
for.
Of years ago, too.
It has. But the students love it. They're very proud of it, as are all of us. We love to come to work here. It's just an incredible monument, but it works perfectly for a law school.
Well, as I said earlier, in one of the reincarnations or incarnations of this ongoing series that we're doing about old Bullocks Wilshire, how wonderful it was that this didn't go the way of many other buildings in LA. It was saved and put to a wonderful use. Now, we need to announce, make sure everybody knows, this building is not open to the general public for daily tours, is it? This is a functioning law school.
It is. We have a lot of activity going on, but what we try and do is every year in late July, we'll have a tour and tea program that is lovely. They can either have a lunch or a tea and a terrific tour of the building. And people can send us an email to let us know that they'd like to be on the mailing list.
Okay, we're putting that on the screen right now.
Okay.
So that people can kind of gear up for the summer tea party
right.
that you have here. And otherwise, people can just drive by and see it on Wilshire Boulevard. There's still things about this building I love. Every time I come over here, I discover them. What is that area called right there, the old, where the autos used to pull in?
That's called the porte cochere.
Porte cochere. And up on top of the porte cochere is this beautiful, is it hand-painted, a hand-painted mural?
Yeah, it's a hand-painted mural, probably just like Michelangelo on a, you know, scaffolding upside down, called The Spirit of Transportation. And it's a beautiful mural that shows all the different modes of transportation of the day, which was back in 1929.
When the building was open, that
when
mural...
When the building was open.
Boy.
But they left out the automobile because the automobile was going to be there in person.
This is where the cars would pull up for the people to go do their shopping.
Right.
And then out front, right on Wilshire Boulevard, we recently did a program about George Stanley, who's one of his many claims to fame was that he actually sculpted, designed the Oscar itself that's
exactly
handed out
that,
every
yeah.
year.
Ooh.
But I found out from one of the historians we were interviewing that he also did something on the Bullocks Wilshire department store, and I went around there before we met up, and sure enough, it's out there right over the front door.
Yes, it's a lovely frieze, and it reflects the motto that John Bullock originally came up with.
Which was,
to build a business that will never know completion. And we know what that feels like.
Absolutely. No, I know what that feels like because this program never knows completion. We keep doing updates, but that's because there's a lot to update from time to time. We were here 10 years ago. Actually, we were here in 1993 for the last day that this wonderful old building functioned as a department store. It has a beautiful new life now. Let's step out of the way so Cameron can get a good shot of the building. We're kind of standing out in the parking lot, but the afternoon sun shining on the back of old Bullocks Wilshire. It's beautiful, it's restored, it's functioning, it's alive and well. Not as Bullocks Wilshire department store, but as a functioning law school. See, there is a happy ending to lots of stories here in Los Angeles, and this is definitely one of them.
Wow. Well, that was some incredible talking.
Yeah, that was chit-chat, paramount chit-chat.
And like remarkably moving.
Yeah.
I found. Even though in some ways, yes, go ahead.
I totally agree. I never thought I'd be so moved by or feel so nostalgic about conspicuous consumption.
Yeah, and everyone's talking about the rich traditions, etc. And you're like, well, how old could this tradition truly be? You know, it's not like Christmas or something. You know, it's like it's just a department store in a city that has seen. It was built in the 30s. But it is one of those things where, similar, I suppose, to my feelings about like there's only one queen that I've known my whole life. You know, there's only one department store that people have known their whole lives, and there's a tea room there. And then there's people that have worked there for, you know, the length of one's whole life, you know.
It's true.
It was like a weird sort of SoCal version of Benjamin's Arcades or something like that, you know, where it's sort of value is only realized and it's passing on. And therefore, you know, and this sort of melancholic aura, I don't know. It was a really powerful segment, actually. And I thought Huell did a lovely job.
Oh, he always does. Yeah.
He's been on before. We've had him on before. But yeah. I just an incredible sort of broad enthusiasm and sort of weird compassion for the people he's speaking to. And people just really open up to him, which is, I think, a really incredible, you know, a really wonderful thing to have in an interviewer.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, one of the senses of nostalgia is I don't feel like we've lived in a time where people identify so straightforwardly with their job, which, you know, for good reasons. But
yeah,
there's a way in which you hear all these people who seem to have really enjoyed working there and felt a sense of meaning and community through it. I mean, of course, they're as alienated as almost any other worker at any other time. But yeah, there's a longing for that in me. You know, it'll never happen.
Yeah.
But
yeah. But no, I know what you mean. And I also sort of feel like there's like a shocking, in a way, I suppose what's also so melancholic about it is it's like these are among the last. That was in the 90s. These are among the last people to ever have that kind of experience, you know, and to have seemingly made a decent living off of retail. You know,
yeah,
like
true.
If you could have been in retail for 40 years and, you know, not been treated like, you know, the idea that somehow that was a job that like had a living wage attached to it. And that also that you got to work somewhere nice, that a store was itself something beautiful. And they talked about it a little bit where they're like, no, everything's plastic and chrome as opposed to, but you know, when you look at the, unfortunately, you know, in Radioland, you can't see it, but the heights of the ceiling are just immense. It's palatial.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you would, you know, sort of come into a place and just feel overwhelmed by the beauty of the building. And then as you sort of glory in that experience, you know, I don't know. Yeah, you're experiencing this incredible, beautiful building, and then you go on from there to sort of, I don't know. I think of my own shopping experiences recently, and it's like I don't feel like any effort has been made to like fill me with wonder upon entry to the Costco or to the Petco or to Best Buy or, you know, like there's no
the economic considerations
of the retailer, of the boss, are so prominent that you can see that like what's important is that the interior is flexible and can be set up in any way possible, and that it's not, you know, historical marble or whatever, you know what I mean? Like it's just like there's no it's not a thing, it's just what you put in the place, and you can change what you put in the place on a dime. Today it's a Toys R Us, tomorrow it's a Spirit Halloween, you know?
Yeah, because I was thinking about the contemporary equivalent in Los Angeles, by my estimation, would be Dover Street Market. I don't know if you've been there, but...
I have not.
You know, it's a very high-end department store with only the hippest brands, and there's a beautiful cafe, et cetera, et cetera. But it looks like a Hauser & Wirth, You know, it's like, oh, it's all right. White. And there are these kind of sectioned booths where, like, say, Comme des Garçons has one. And they bring people in and they, you know, make fancy coat racks and things for it and some furnishings. But you get the sense, like an art fair, that they could just get, it could get swapped out next week for, you know.
A
different designer line, which I think I've been there twice since they opened. Mostly just to go to the cafe and look at clothes because they're preposterously expensive. But and they swap them out. It's like, of course, there's always a Prada area, but like some of the lesser brands that you had never heard of are not there 6 months later or whatnot.
Huh.
It's more of the modularity you're talking about, but even at the highest end.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, maybe like, you know, when I was in New York or whatever, there are like the high street versions of each of these brands, but each of those things is its own individual retail space. It's not the sort of like overarching, just like come to a nice place and buy stuff.
Right.
And calm
down with some tea afterwards.
Yeah. And we'll look after you. Yeah, it just seems absolutely ridiculous. And you can work here for 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have to say that it was one of those things where I was it seemed like I did feel a little sad. You know, I remember the end of the Grand Department Store era in Toronto. There was a similar sort of situation, but at that point, the sort of reigning, the company was called Eaton's, and it was, and they had already made the move. They had built a giant postmodern mall sort of next to, or on the, you know, the site where their previous sort of old sort of semi-Georgian stack used to be, sort of late Victorian department store. And then they had built this brand new, very, you know, tubes and tunnels, Centre Pompidou kind of thing. And due to mismanagement, you know, they went bankrupt, and Eaton's is now, I think, well, for a while, like, you know, the actual space in the department store that used to be Eaton's has now been all kinds of things. Like, part of it is an H&M. It figures prominently, the mall itself figures prominently in the thrilling Elliot Gould film, The Silent Partner, if anyone wants to see the mall itself. But they sort of like, you know, initiated their own destruction, basically. Like, they built their new sort of temple and then were themselves modularly removed from it, you know, like, and at the same time, though, now that mall seems awfully quaint, you know, like, it's obviously from the early 80s. You know, when you go to the Glendale Galleria, you feel a sort of sense of nostalgia. You're like, oh, I could get an Orange Julius here, you know. which you don't feel, you know, you certainly don't have that feeling when you're at like the Americana or something like that. And soon, you know, due to municipal politics, everything will be the Americana, right? We're just going to live in the sort of greater Americana at Brand.
Yeah.
That'll be our fate.
Yeah. Kind of the way that the Grove swallowed the Hollywood, what is the Hollywood Farmers Market? That'll be town hall, or the city hall will just be consumed by a shopping mall.
Yeah, exactly. Which in some cases is remarkably consonant with the sort of ennui of the Bullock's department store closing. But then in other respects is like, I don't think anyone could have imagined that. But, you know, one of the only places you can go and experience lofty marble ceilings and stuff like that is actually City Hall, where you are free to go.
True.
So anyway, a fascinating talking and weirdly emotional. You know, my mom worked at one of the fancier department stores that went bankrupt before Eaton's in Canada. It's called Simpsons. I think Simpsons was my memories of Simpsons as a child, after my mom had worked there. But I caught the end of Simpsons when I was a little boy, and I remember it being quite fancy.
I think department stores for the generations before us had the weight of like a church or something. Because I was in preparing for Huell's talk tonight, I was looking into some of the history in LA, and the LA Public Library was housed in a department store for a while. So that made sense, you know, culturally to be like, oh, yeah, floor four is women's knits, 4-5 is the LAPL. And then also LACMA occupied. Yeah, LACMA occupied a former department store, one of the May department stores, which is now the Academy Museum. That building was a department store.
I see.
So they must have held a position in culture where, like, those two public institutions were totally okay, just, like, amongst the commercial floors.
You know, and in Japan, for example, it's not weird at all that a department store will have, like, an art gallery on one floor. Just complete integration, you know, like, not a commercial gallery. So it's like, hey, you know, you on the ground floor in the basement, there's groceries, for example. And then as you move, so you move from sort of, like, something you could consume immediately. Then there's a fancy tea room. There's a regular cafeteria that, you know, like there's, you sort of move from like something you can consume, take home and consume immediately to things you can take home and consume at different sort of time scales. Then like above the art gallery is the restaurants. Then above the restaurants is the driving range on the roof.
Wow.
Yeah. Just like everything's in there. What do you want to consume? You know? But you know, again, I feel like, those interiors are malleable. Those are, curtain wall, steel frame, high rise buildings. If the department store closes, you could put offices in, you know, within a month kind of thing.
It's true.
There isn't a lot of interior space that's, you know, other than keeping the steel beams in their spots, which, you know, otherwise the whole thing falls over. There's not a lot to be said. So I think it's really interesting that, I think it's fascinating that we're in this position. You know, I think it's where like the building has to keep standing. Basically, like the department store exists now without, you know, it's like it's so non-modular that other things have to accommodate themselves to it. Like a law school has to twist into a shape to be inside a department store now. You know, and maybe when we're like surprised that like a library or a municipal art gallery were in a department store, maybe those things weren't so different from retail in the first place. Or who knows, you know, it's like, is it a bookstore or is it a library? You know, they kind of look the same if you're not careful. But anyway, yeah, just a fascinating combination of people and stuff and memories, and also just like imagining these eras when like you would wear white gloves to go to the store.
Yeah.
Versions of what it was to be a woman that I think, you know, speaking of the woman I know best in my life, I can't imagine, you know, I've seen her wear white gloves to like handle paintings, but that's about it. You know? There was a time when my spouse was an art handler, and that was the only time that the white gloves got used. I can't imagine, you know? And these sort of tales of like this ritual passing on from like mother to daughter, like, and I take you to the tea room, my daughter, to have the tea and have your hair in braid, you know, just like an entire production that manufactured itself within this, sort of inter and post-war period, you know, this era of weird American prosperity. I just can't, like, what a special time. Like, because I feel like that time is over now. You know, like going to the store sucks. It's abusive.
The only mall is the internet.
Yeah. The mall is actually, like, something you do in a moment of weakness in between, like, having a bowel movement and wiping. You know, like, that's when I do most of my impulse buys. You know, like, when something catches your eye and and you say like, oh, okay, fine. And then like, you're like, oh, damn it. And then you're like, I should get off the toilet. yeah, that's, you know, so it's like literally the store is now the toilet. Just crazy, you know, like it's the exact opposite of like this palace you would go to. And I mean, as a obviously it seems much less determined for men than it did for women, you know, who I guess did more shopping in general. But it seems like it was awfully pleasant to shop there as a, you know, that guy with the mustache, he would look after you, you know, it feels like that would be nice.
No, it's true. And they remember you and remember what you liked and show you the new things you might like.
Yeah. These cufflinks. Hey.
Yeah.
These would look good. I've, you know, you, those blue shirts you get, this would, you know, check this out. I don't know. Yeah, it's great. I suppose there, Amazon does try to do the same thing where it does suggest that I get, what are the recent things it suggested I get? It suggested I get a possum riding inside a peanut. It's a sort of pull action toy. And it says like, hey, maybe you want... So like it looks at what the kinds of things I'm interested in so far as it's aware. And it's like, would you like to buy this toy possum riding in a peanut? I can't say I wasn't tempted, so I suppose the old ways still survive in a horribly mangled, you know, like from inside the Matrix, like that salesman with the mustache is being absorbed by the Borg and is, you know, screaming from inside the machine while he's being absorbed, you know, like, would you like to buy the possum in a peanut? That's what's happening, right?
Well, I think the next time... I'm suggested to purchase some 220 grit sandpaper designed for sanding plastics, I will do so wearing white gloves and see if it really brings back all of the feelings that our guest tonight described. I think that's maybe the only thing that's missing from really that Bullock's Wilshire experience today.
Yeah, yeah.
From the
comfort of your own commode, you know, while you're on the commode, just slip on those gloves and, you know, try with the glove on to click add to cart, click the boxes that see if your phone can detect your thumb through the white glove.
Buy it now.
Buy it now. Buy it now.
Yeah.
Nicholas?
I will.
Buy it now.
I will.
Good night, Chinatown.
Good morning.
Buy it now.